We're in luck.
Bubbles inched backwards around the corner, fighting her terror of the blackness.
Light!
It flared too brightly in the dark goggles. Bubbles tore them away and stared. Rafa had found an old-fashioned candle lantern and the striker to light it. Without the goggles, it lit the space around them only dimly, yet it felt so much better. That warm flame, the color of afternoon sunlight. Bubbles tried to breathe slowly and calmly and felt her body gradually relax. They were hidden. They had light. They were, after all, alive.
Do you think it's safe?
In daylight, certainly. They can't see a little light like this around the corner, not after being out in real daylight. At night, they'd still have to put their heads through that vine curtain and maybe see sparkles on the water.
Rafa put the lantern back on the stone shelf it had come from. Bubbles saw there the other evidence of Kell's occupation, his initials carved into the stone above the ledge, a row of seashells and colored stones, a tangle of wire leaders, coils of fishing line and some fish hooks, and a pile of wooden blocks, all daubed with white painted numbers and lengths of twine with lead weights attached.
I wonder what that's all about. They look like bobbers for fishing, but why so many? And why numbered?
Rafa, meanwhile, was exploring the space below.
Look at this. A sleeping bag or something soft, anyway. My aching bones will appreciate that.
I wish I knew if the water was safe. We still have some, but...
We could look for dead fish.
Rafa picked up the candle lantern again and carried it to the water's edge. When she held it low, Bubbles could see how clear the water was, how pale and unappealing the bottom. Something almost colorless fled through the edge of the light.
Fish! My aunt's caves had some pools with fish like this. No color, shy of light.
So it's probably not poisoned, if these fish are susceptible to the same poison.
So you do pay attention in class sometimes. Maris claims she had to spoon-feed you all your answers to the exams.
Maris couldn't tell the truth if she were being interrogated under truth serum by the Imperium. I don't mind learning things, but, oh, you know how it is.
Never show how smart you are, dears, or someone will envy you. And then we are supposed to show how rich and prominent our families are, as if no one would envy that.
In the faint glow of the lantern, Bubbles could not quite read the expression that Rafa turned to her.
Do you mind if I ask something?
No. While we're hiding in a cave from people who want to kill us, I think your questions are not going to be that threatening.
Why do you let them call you Bubbles?
Oh, that. I'm sorry. That's a long story. And well suited to this place, I guess. You have brothers and cousins, though. You'll understand. The fashion for old Earth. North European great names was at its height. You know, we're all stuck with things like Sicily and Marilis and, oh, Guinevere. Your Raffaella's actually pretty, but some of them, oh.
Like my cousin Boethia Evangeline and my brother Archibald Ferdinand.
Right. Well, Mother had finally come over to fashion, after reasonably naming Gary and Tige. Buttons got stuck with Bertram, Harold, Sivola. I really think they made a mistake there. Sivola doesn't sound British to me, but Mother said it was an important name in history somewhere. Then I came along. You promise you won't tell?
Tell whom? The hunters? Don't be ridiculous.
All right. Brunhilde Charlotte.
What?
Brunhilde Charlotte. Now, you don't have to make a production out of it. Anyway, Buttons is only 2 years older, and when they told him he had a baby sister named Brunhilde, he could only say Bubba. And my mother thought it was cute. She liked the idea of a little girl called Bubbles. And then I turned out blonde, and Champagne Bubbles became the family form of Brunhilde Charlotte. They all thought it was cute. I was only a baby, Rafa. I didn't know what they were setting me up for.
So you sort of lived out the Bubbles persona, like Dr. Fisher Wong in psych class says happens.
Well, some children are naturally cheerful and
bubbly, I know. But You're not the fluff head you act like sometimes, and you haven't been acting like a pile of bubbles on this little jaunt.
No. Well, to be honest, I've been getting tired of bubbles myself. But look at the alternative. Brunhilde? What kind of a name is that?
Brun isn't bad as a short form. Wonder what it meant.
For all I know, Brunhilde is the old Earth equivalent of Bubblehead. But it sounds better and better the more people snicker at bubbles. I should have changed it years ago. But my cousin Kel, the one who found this cave, he was just the sort to make nasty jokes. He gave me so much grief about bubbles, I pretended to like it, just to blunt the point.
You could use Charlotte. Shara. That's not bad. Or Brun.
Well, that decision won't matter if we don't survive, and we won't survive without water. So the next step, I think, is to check it out.
With your portable chemistry kit, of course.
With Kel's portable chemistry kit. The one on the shelf that you didn't recognize.
But the little bottles and tubes were all empty. Their contents, no more than a few dried grains of unrecognizable grit.
With our brains, we can think it out. It's safe for the cave fish. They're alive.
Alive now?
Yes, and that's all we can go on. They're swimming normally. They're not gasping or floating. And that means...
Look, whatever it was had to be pretty quick. Not more than a day. Because Petrus told us they'd never bothered the water. That flyover could have dropped the poison or set someone down to do it afoot. So if one of us drinks here and nothing happens in a day, then this water's safe.
I'll drink. It's my island. Maybe it will just put me to sleep or something.
Or only make you throw up once. You're a gutsy wench. And you shouldn't be stuck with Bubbles one day longer. Take your pick, Brun or Shara.
Bubbles sat back on her heels.
Well, I'm used to the bee. Let's try Brun. If I hate it tomorrow, no one else ever needs to know.
If she died of poison, no one would ever know. Bubbles shoved that thought away.
Good for you, Brun. Now, how can we do the hunters the most harm?
Ronnie could not tell whether the pounding in his head was from the concussion or excitement.
I told you, we should have put our trap on the creek itself.
Ronnie wanted to say shut up, but the person at the creek might hear. Instead, he touched George's wrist, a sharp tap.
Let's follow. Maybe we can take him.
Wait, the spring's not that far away. He may come back and spring the trap.
He ought to be more careful.
We too.
After an interminable period, they heard sounds returning. The same hunter? Another whose planned route had crossed his? One of Petrus's men? Ronnie didn't know. His neck prickled. He felt that someone was looking at him, that he was outlined by a spotlight. He blinked hard. No spotlight, nothing but darkness. Whoever it was coming down slope stayed in the water for the most part. He moved faster, as most people do going downhill, and as if he could see his way. He passed their position, still moving downstream, and did not turn aside along his former path. Apparently, he was going to follow the stream all the way down.
This is stupid. If we stay here...
Ronnie's control broke. He grabbed George's mouth and dug his fingernails into his lips.
The idea is to stay alive. Be quiet.
He let go as quickly as he'd grabbed, and they spent the remaining hours of darkness in icy silence, both furious. They heard no cries, nor anything that let them know what was happening. In the first faint light of dawn, when Ronnie realized he could see his hand in front of his face again, the peaceful gurgle of the creek off to their left seemed to mock their fears. Not even the amphibians were making their usual racket. No sound but the faint sigh of a breeze in the leaves far overhead, and the water in the creek, and the sound of waves below, borne on the wind. He had heard no shots for a long time. His head ached dully, an ache he was almost used to now. His eyes burned. He felt stiff, dirty, sore, but alive. He looked at George, who had fallen asleep, leaning against a tree. Perhaps he should let George sleep a little longer. But as he thought it, George woke up, almost falling.
We survived.
The sound of his own voice woke painful echoes in Ronnie's head. George rubbed his eyes, looking disgusted but still dapper. When he brushed at a smudge on his sleeve, it actually vanished.
Survived? We should have gone after that fellow. We haven't done anything useful yet.
He gave their trap an angry glance. Even in that early light, the leaves they had cut to conceal it drooped and no longer matched the greenery around them. Ronnie hadn't realized that they'd wilt in only 12 hours or so.
It was a stupid idea, just the sort of thing you might expect from someone like Petrus.
All he said was to stay up in this area, and perhaps we could trap someone. You're the one who had the idea for the trap itself.
George glared, but silently. Ronnie wondered if they should take the now obvious trap apart or leave it. Moment by moment, the light increased, and the trap's outline became clearer. It would take a very stupid hunter to step into it now.
We'll have to clear that mess up. It certainly won't fool anyone.
I suppose not.
Ronnie wanted to lie down and sleep, preferably for 2 days straight, and wake up in a clean, comfortable bed. He did not look forward to undoing the trap, particularly when he couldn't remember exactly how the lines ran on this side.
Although, suppose we left it, and they saw it and sniggered. And then we had another trap they didn't see.
Like what? Dig a pit trap with our fingernails and disguise it with more wilting greenery?
Perhaps a snare sort of thing. You know, where a rock drops on them.
Somewhere in some class, Ronnie remembered seeing something. A leaning stick or limb, with something heavy balanced above, and when someone went through...
A rock. And where are we supposed to find more rope and a rock?
Evidently, George didn't have the same illustration in mind. Ronnie didn't think his had rope in it. His head and stomach renewed yesterday's quarrel.
Oh, I've got to sit down.
George, after all, had slept standing up. George grabbed his arm as he went down, more a fall than a controlled descent.
You look awful.
Ronnie felt slightly less sick lying on his back, but his head pounded just the same. George's thumb appeared in front of his face.
Focus on this, can you?
He could, but he didn't really want to let George assess his eye's ability to focus. George wasn't even a medic, let alone a doctor. He let his eyes close.
I'll get water.
Aside from the untalented drummer in his head, lovely dark silence lay around him. No buzzing insects, no barking amphibians. He remembered how startled he'd been to find how loud a sound those tiny wet bodies could make. He wiggled his shoulders in the soft leaves, hoping no biting insects would get him, and felt his stiff muscles relax. He did not know he was falling asleep until he woke. The sun had speared through a break in the forest canopy, directly into his eyelid. He squinted, twisted. He still hurt, though not as badly. He had slept some hours. Too many hours. It must be near midday. George should not have let him sleep so long. He forced himself up on one arm and looked around. He couldn't see George. Silence lay on the forest, heavy and dangerous. It wouldn't be that still if nothing was wrong. Slowly, carefully, Ronnie sat up, then levered himself to one knee, then to his feet. Nothing stirred. No birds, no insects, nothing. His mouth tasted foul, and his lips were dry.
George?
He had gone for water. Ronnie remembered that much. And after a short panic, remembered which way the stream was. He glanced at the trap. The leaves covering it were now a sickly brown, and eased his way toward the creek as quietly as possible. It lay in a steep-sided bed, just here. He could see the glint of water trickling down from a pool above before he could see it right below him. Then he saw George. George sprawled gracelessly, as if he'd simply slumped to the ground while climbing back toward Ronnie. Ronnie looked around for the enemy he assumed had shot him, but saw and heard nothing. When he looked again, he saw no blood, no burn mark, no injury at all. Ronnie sank to his heels and tried to think this out. George down, without a cry, but he could now see his back move, breathing.
Did he just fall asleep? Why there?
He glanced at the creek and frowned. From here, he could see something floating, a bit of scum or something. He stood and moved closer to George. George was definitely breathing, and from the new angle, he could see that his eyes were closed.
George!
He reached out and touched George's shoulder. No response. He glanced around again, sure someone was watching, but saw and heard nothing at all. George's slack hand lay atop the water bottle he'd carried to the creek. Its cap had come off in the fall, and it held only a scant swallow or two. Ronnie poured it on George's face, hoping to wake him. But aside from a grimace, George did not rouse. Perhaps more would work. With another look around, Ronnie took the bottle to the creek to refill it. The scum he had seen lay in drifts against the rock. At first, he didn't recognize it. But when he swished it away to put the bottle in, there were the limp legs and tails of the red and gold amphibians, the motionless fins of tiny fish. Dead, beginning to stink. He stared at them, his hand frozen in place, not quite touching the water, the bottle half immersed. Then he moved his arm back and let the bottle drip to the ground. Thoughts whirled through his mind in odd fragments. The man they'd heard last night. The silence, nothing croaking or barking after he came back downstream. George asleep. The dead things. The water he hadn't touched. He hoped the dizziness he felt suddenly came from his concussion, or even from fear, and not from the touch of that contaminated water. That unseen hunter had somehow poisoned the water, killed everything in it, and whatever it was put George to sleep. Or was he dying? Ronnie staggered back to George and felt the pulse at his neck. It beat slowly, but regularly, against his sweaty fingers. He shook George's shoulder. Again, no response. A frantic look upstream and down. Tree trunks, vines, bushes, rocks. No moving figures, no sounds that shouldn't be there. But if the poison was supposed to put anyone who drank the water to sleep, that meant someone might come to collect them. He couldn't leave George so near the water out in the open. He grabbed George firmly under the arms.
Oh, my head. Oh, it's not going to work.
His headache escalated from dull throbbing to loud rhythmic pounding, and his stiff ribs felt as if someone had dragged sharp knives across them. George, meanwhile, had hardly moved a centimeter.
I need a whatchamacallit, something to drag him on.
He looked around. An older cousin had gone through a period of enthusiastic camping, but Ronnie spent that long vacation at a music school, honing what his mother fondly believed to be superlative talent. After hearing his cousin's stories, most of them involving borderline criminal assaults on the younger campers, he milked the talent he himself knew to be minor and managed another session of music school. By then, his older cousin had moved on to other amusements, and Ronnie had escaped even 1 6-week session at his brother's camp. Right now, he would have accepted a few tosses into ice-cold ponds, burr-pricked mounts, or stinging crawlers in bunks for some of the practical knowledge Knut had claimed. Ways to drag heavy loads when you didn't have lifters or flitters, ways to make traps that actually worked. His first version of the travoy bound with vines cost Ronnie 3 blisters, an itchy rash from the vine sap, and most of the hours of the afternoon. When he finally rolled George onto the vines and lifted the handles...
Oh, goddamn son of a motherless...
George's limp body worked quickly through the vines to the ground before Ronnie had, with great difficulty, pulled it 10 meters. Ronnie untangled George and tried to weave the vines into a more stable configuration. That was when he noticed the itching rash. He had never woven so much as a potholder. He knew in theory how weaving worked, but nothing about fishnets or hammocks or anything else that would hold a 70-kilo body safely between two poles as someone dragged them along. He did not let himself notice hunger or thirst, but the darkness creeping out from under the trees finally blurred his vision before he had anything that would support George. He had tried dragging 3 times, and all he had to show for it were the obvious scars in the forest soil. And now it was almost too dark to see. His hands were itching, burning, shaking, and when he tried to stand, cramps seized his legs and arms. He staggered. Now he was thirsty, his mouth burned. He took several steps toward the creek before he remembered.
Don't panic. Think.
But he could not remember when he had thought last. Days ago, it seemed. For a moment, it was hard to think where he was or why. Then it came clear. They had had supplies, of course they had, back where the trap was. He could get water there and food. He started back in the near dark, hoping he could recognize which dark blur was the right tree. The worst thing about being in a cave, Bubbles thought, was how you could lose track of time. They had drunk some of that cool, clean water, eaten a little food, and then, while trying to figure out all the things Kel left, day had turned to night. Even with night goggles on, she could see nothing. If they left the candle burning, anyone who looked in the entrance might see it sparkle on the water, and she didn't want to go outside and make sure no gleam showed through the leaves. Sleep came to them slowly, with many starts and twitches, but they were both still tired from the night before, and finally slept.
I'm not Bubbles anymore. I'm grown up now. I'm someone else, named Brun.
In the darkness, they could not tell how far off it fell, only that it was inside and not outside. Bubbles had slept with the goggles on, and when she woke, could just make out a paler smudge beyond the rock buttress. Rafa's hand reaching for hers almost made her squeak. She squeezed Rafa's hand and then put it aside. She would have to crawl to the edge of the buttress and look around to see how near daylight was. When she got to the corner of the buttress, she could see light seeping in from the entrance. Not as bright as the day before, if it was the day before. Had they slept the clock around? But enough to show that no one was in the visible part of the cave. If someone had caused the rock fall, they were now out of sight. She started to creep around the buttress and realized suddenly that her knees were wet. The pool was rising. Yesterday, there had been at least 2 meters between the buttress and the pool, and 1 meter between the pool and the entrance. Now, the gleam of light reflecting from water extended to the entrance, perhaps even outside. She backed up until her feet bumped into Rafa.
I think it's raining. The pool's up.
Can we get out?
For now, yes. It's probably not more than a couple of centimeters at the entrance, and I doubt it goes much higher for long. That's never a large creek out there.
The creek bed? Yes. If it actually flows, it'll take care of our tracks coming in.
What about our tracks going out? And with water coming out there? Oh, it's obvious there's something inside.
Maybe we won't have to go out. Let's look.
Rafa lighted the candle lantern again, and they peered at the water, then the cave walls. A pale streak, topped by a dark one, ran along the wall perhaps knee-high. Farther up, a blurrier mark showed.
That's common. Probably a seasonal flood. And the other is older and rare. Didn't you say there were seasonal rains?
Yes, and this is supposed to be the dry season.
Rafa pointed to the lower mark.
Well then, I'll bet it won't get that high.
That's our lives you're betting.
That sounds like Bubbles and not Brun. It's our lives either way. If we go out now, they'll have nice muddy footsteps to show where we were. How long do the off-season rainstorms last?
Only a few hours usually, but they can drop a lot of rain when they hit. Oh, I'm not used to being Brun, you know? It's going to take some getting used to. You're right. It's not likely to come up even as high as the wet season flood mark. And even if it does, we can climb. There are ledges. We can use Kel's floaters and weights to mark the pool's edge and see how fast it's rising.
She took down the pile of floats and poked the weight tied to one at the edge of the water. Luckily, they had a supply of candles for the lantern and need not sit in the faint light that came from around the buttress. A bar of concentrate eased the hunger pangs, but Bubbles would have been very glad of a hot breakfast. The cave's damp coolness no longer seemed a comfortable refuge from the heat outside. Slowly, the water rose. Each hour, Bubbles put another weight at the edge of the water. The first one now lay 2 centimeters under. The last, as the third hour came to an end, was hardly covered by a skim of water. Rafa gave Bubbles an affectionate shove.
Made it.
Rafa reached out and snuffed the candle in the lantern. Darkness closed around them. They dared not move, lest they trip on something and make a noise. Bubbles slipped the dark goggles back on to find her vision just as black. Then a ray of light flared across. Someone had flashed a light inside.
Nothing. There's water right up to the entrance. If anyone had come inside, we'd see the marks.
Maybe they got here before the rain.
Not likely. Nothing. No sounds, no movement. Nothing on IR scan.
Bubbles blessed the thick rock that lay between them and the entrance, and the cold cave water that had covered any mark they'd left. She had thought of the hunters having dark goggles. She'd forgotten the special equipment on the rifles.
What about those weapons?
Nah, they'll be basic by now. They don't have any way to invalidate them. Come on.
The light vanished. Bubbles realized she was shaking and tried to take deep, slow breaths. What had they meant the weapons would be basic by now? She reached out and found Rafa's shoulder. Rafa grabbed her back and they hugged, both of them still trembling. For an unmeasured time, they clung together until they were both breathing normally.
We were stupid. We didn't even have our weapons within reach.
Oh, it's so hard to believe. I keep remembering the old camping trips. We played at chase and smuggling and capture, but it was just play. Though we took it seriously then, and now it's real. Oh, but it's so hard to keep remembering that.
I'm going to check that rifle. It can't have a locator, or they'd have known it. Must have been something else. Ah, I see. That socket on the side must be for a computer link, probably an ID chip. That's what they meant by validation. None of the good stuff works now. The rangefinder, IR scope, all that. But it'll still fire.
Which means?
It can't see in the dark. We have to be better. But if we avoid them completely, we won't need them anyway.
Bubbles had forgotten the earlier alarm, the sound of falling rocks. But when it came again, she remembered. Something was in the cave with them. Her mind pictured all the large predators on the planet, even though she knew none were on the island.
What was that?
Bubbles lifted the rifle, although she had no target at all.
Rocks, I guess. Maybe the water loosened something and it just fell.
Ronnie had found the meager catch of food and water, and a couple of swallows restored some of his wits. He couldn't move George alone. Even if he got the vines woven the right way, dragging the travois alone would leave obvious tracks. He would have to find Petrus and the others, even though that had been against his orders. He sucked at a ration bar, letting the surface coating of salt and sugar revive him, then took another swig from the safe bottle. He shouldn't eat much, he remembered, if he was short of water. If only it weren't dark. If only his head didn't hurt. If only he had someone to help him. But reality settled on his shoulders like a cloak of misery. Dark, hurt, alone. Either he figured it out, or no one would. He made his way back to George's unconscious body in the dark, tripping more than once on unseen roots and stones. How long would the drug or poison keep George unconscious? He wished he knew more about drugs. He tried to redo the vines in the dark by feel, but his heart wasn't in it. A drop of cold water flicked his hot neck, and he jumped. Then another.
If I can pull George along, the rain will wash out our tracks.
Ronnie didn't let himself think how much harder it would be to pull the travois through mud. Instead, he yanked at the poles, straining, staggering uphill, away from the creek. Suddenly, it was easy. He lurched forward, almost jogging, then realized that must mean George had fallen off, or through, the vine webbing.
Oh!
It was too much. The pain in his head, the rain, the danger, the uncooperative vines. He had just found George's body when he saw the lights in the sky. A flitter, its searchlight directed into the forest.
Bloody hell!
He threw himself back, away from George. They had IR sensors, of course, and night vision goggles. They could see George. They could see him. He crouched, shaking from fear and exertion. Above the wind and thickening rain, he could just hear the flitter's drone. Its searchlight flicked among the trees, probing. But the canopy was thick here, near the stream, and the light never touched him. It did flick across George, and that garish belt pack he refused to bury. And it came back and centered there. The flitter sank into the canopy, its searchlight illuminating slanting lines of rain above and drips below.
They'll have a ladder, or a line, for dropping hunters directly into the forest. If I stay here...
He plunged away into darkness. Upslope, upstream, into the thicker forest and more broken country. If he could get rock between him and the IR scans, they couldn't see him. He picked his way from tree to tree in the dim radiance of the flitter's light. It would do no good to hurry. He must not fall and make a noise. He had a few seconds, perhaps, as someone came down the line from the flitter, someone who surely must be concentrating on a safe descent rather than a possible fugitive. Light brightened behind him. He dared a peek and saw a light source at head level, a helmet light, feebler than the flitter's searchlight, but perfectly adequate for close work. It lowered as if its bearer crouched. Over George, Ronnie was sure. He struggled against the desire to go back and protect his friend. Now, two helmet lights glowed back there. He had to leave. He had to go now, while they did whatever they were doing to George, because they must not catch all four of them. That was the only chance. But he had never imagined that he might have to leave a friend behind. He made himself move, one slow step after another, away from the lights.
I'm sorry, George. I'm sorry.
He made it, perhaps 50 meters.
Hey!
Reflex threw him forward into a wild, panicky run.
Over there!
Ronnie fell over another rock, banging both shins, and scrambled up. Too late for silence, for subtlety. Only speed would help him now. He tried to move faster through his memory of what the lightning revealed and fell again. He was in the creek, now only a meter wide. Rain lashed at him as he climbed, stumbled, climbed again. Ronnie struggled on, uphill, ignoring everything but the need to get away. His feet slipped on wet rocks, in mud. Rain beat his face, plastered his hair down, dragging at his shirt and trousers. Flash after flash of lightning revealed a grotesque landscape of wind-whipped foliage, ragged rocks, wind-tossed rain. He followed the creek, no longer worried about the poison in its water until he reached its source. Behind him, he could see flickering lights, the hunters, following what must be an obvious trail. He licked his lips, grateful for the pure rainwater that drenched him.
Where now?
The next flash of lightning showed him a narrow black cleft above and to his right. He clambered over the wet rocks, hoping it was deep enough to hide in, hoping it wasn't just a trick of lightning.
There he is!
Behind him, a stab of light. His shoulder burned. He plunged to the ground behind a rock and tried to see where the cleft had been. Lightning again. There, only a jump and a stretch. It still looked deep, a black gash in the rocky slope. He forced himself to stand, to take those few steps, to reach up and haul himself into darker darkness. When the next lightning came, he saw it as a blue-white flash against dark walls. Limping, staggering, he tried to work his way further in. Water trickled along between his feet, getting deeper. Pebbles rolled, and he lurched against the rocks, biting his tongue at the pain in his shoulder. Then the ground fell out from under his feet, and he slid down a crumbling slope into black oblivion. George awoke with a stiff neck and aching head. It was dark.
Night?
He tried to stretch and discovered that his wrists were bound behind his back.
Oh, this will never do.
He blinked several times and drew in a breath that stank of cleaning solution, old wood, and sour water. He felt around with his legs, glad to find that his captors had not tied his ankles. He could sit up, though he felt dizzy. The mind his father always doubted he had began to work. He couldn't remember how he'd gotten into this, but his friends never pulled tricks this unpleasant. He forced his mind back to the last clear memory, then tried to go forward. The flight to the island, the crash, Ronnie, pale and sick, the ragged islanders who claimed to be the victims of a manhunt. He and Ronnie building a trap of leaves and branches. A sound in the night. Dawn. Then nothing. He had not liked capture the first time, with Petrus and Oblo. This time, when he was sure it was their enemies, he liked it less. He had been captured somehow, that he could not yet remember, and he was confined in something that sounded and smelled like a closet for cleaning supplies. The others must still be free, or some of them, or he would be dead. He brushed that thought aside. He, George Starbridge Mahoney, was not going to die. That would not happen. Sordid deaths happen to others, not to young men of good family whose trousers never lost their crease. He was going to escape, and warn Lord Thornbuckle, and then go rescue Ronnie and the others. And the first thing to do was find out more about his prison. With difficulty, he levered himself up to his feet. It was remarkably hard to find his balance in the dark. He backed up slowly until his hands bumped a wall. His fingers recognized wood, then something papery, then more wood. He edged along, feeling for a corner, and bumped into a shelf that caught him painfully above the elbows. He felt a small bump against his back as a bottle on the shelf fell over and rolled. It occurred to him then that he should not let that object fall off the shelf. It would make noise, and noise might bring his captors, and his captors might think he knew where the others were hiding. His captors might even be unpleasant. He had not enjoyed the classes on interrogation resistance, which even the royals found necessary. He wanted nothing to do with the real thing. He leaned a little on the shelf, trying to encourage the small item to roll backwards, and the entire shelf fell off its supports. Fumes rose and stung his nose. His eyes burned. Tears rolled down his face. Light stabbed his eyes, and he lunged toward it, but the shadowy figures there shoved him back so hard that he could not keep his feet. He fell against the bucket and sat down hard in a puddle of whatever it was with the strong smell. He could feel it oozing through his expensive Gilsanmi trousers.
Oh, damn it!
Shut up or you'll get another dose.
Another dose. That meant he'd been drugged or poisoned. He had a tiny, shrinking vision of a creak, of a full water flask coming to his lips. With that memory came thirst, worse even than his headache.
I'm thirsty.
The unpleasant laugh reminded George of the senior bully the year he'd started school.
Too bad, but not for long.
No, wait. If they autopsy, they'll look for dehydration.
George tried to squint past the lights aimed at him, but still could not see either figure, or if there were more than two.
So, seawater might do that.
Nah, the old man said take care of them until we got the whole bunch.
He didn't say tell them the whole plan.
George glanced around the closet. In the light of its single fixture, it was as cramped and unpleasant as his experience in the dark suggested. It was about 2 by 3 meters, with the door in the middle of one long side, and shelves on either side of the door. Above the shelf he'd broken, 2 more supported a collection of brushes, cans, and jugs. On the other side of the door, the shelves held bathroom supplies in neatly labeled boxes. Behind him, mops and brooms hung from a rack. He had been lucky not to dislodge any of them when he fell over the mop bucket. It had to be a large house or building, probably on the neighboring island. Bandon, its name was. Bandon, where the landing field had signaled that they were unwelcome. Where the hunters, according to Petrus, were living in comfort in the lodge, while the victims struggled to survive on the island. George shook his head at the state of his trousers, which the bright light revealed to have suffered from the island even before the noxious green liquid that still filled his nose with stinging vapor. Never in his life had he been this disheveled. He noticed a rip in one sleeve and a long, greasy stain, as if he'd been thrown in a dirty cargo compartment for the trip here. He probably had. And without the use of his hands, he could not even tidy himself up. But he could get out of the puddle of smelly green stuff, which he was sure would do his trousers more harm than simple grime. For all he knew, it would eat its way through his skin as well. He braced his back against the wall of mops and stood. There. He could just grasp the handle of a mop. There ought to be some way of using it as a weapon the next time those persons opened the door. But he couldn't think of one.
You weren't supposed to get up.
With the two spotlights trained on his face, he still could see nothing of the men holding them.
I couldn't breathe. That stuff chokes me.
I wouldn't worry about that. But you said you were thirsty. Come on, then.
Was it safe to go out? It wasn't safe to stay here, he knew that much. He tried to step forward with assurance, as if he weren't even worried, but the green liquid was slippery as oil. He staggered and fell into the doorframe. Ungentle hands caught him under the armpits.
You're a regular comedy act, aren't you?
Thick cloth muffled his head, blinding him, and he felt hands, large, strong, and gloved, he thought, yank him along. He tried to judge what sort of space they were in, how far they'd come. A corridor, he thought, but he could not judge distance, not with the hard hands shoving him this way and that, breaking his concentration with slams against the wall or yanks on his bound arms. Finally, he heard a door open. A swing door, he thought, and a final shove sent him forward through it, just as the cloth was pulled away from his face. He staggered and fell onto a hard, cold floor in the dark. For a time, he lay there, nursing his new bruises, and wondering what to do now. But thirst drove him to explore. This smelled different, cleaner, colder, like a bathroom, he decided. He got to his knees and considered shuffling around like that, but the hard floor hurt his knees after only a few awkward moves, and he realized he would have to stand up again. This exploration, however, ended in success. He found the door through which he'd been shoved, and beside it the predictable panel of switches to control light and ventilation. Cool white light showed him a bathroom, certainly a staff facility, for it had none of the amenities the family rooms would have had. A row of sinks set into a counter with mirrors above, he winced away from his image, and a row of plumbing fixtures. The stack of clean glasses on the counter mocked him.
How am I supposed to turn the water on? Or get it in the glass?
That struggle occupied him some time. The sinks had water-saving faucets, so that they would not run long without a finger on the control, and the control was mounted at a convenient height for someone with free hands.
Oh.
George had to hitch himself up onto a sink, almost sitting in it, to reach the control. He was sure the entire counter and sinks arrangement was going to fall off the wall and cause a flood. He could turn the water on, but he could not drink, not while facing away from the sink. And the sinks had no plugs, so he could not fill one and drink from it. Finally, he realized that he would have to take a glass from the stack and position it in a sink, all out of his sight, and then climb up to start the water and hope the glass was in the right position. Then take the glass out of the sink and set it on the counter, close enough to the edge that he could tip it with his mouth and finally drink. It took a very long time. He broke two glasses, cut his fingers, and almost decided that thirst was better than this struggle. But his stubbornness forced him on, and the lukewarm water, the half glass of it he managed to drink before the glass tipped over and spilled the rest down his chin and neck, tasted amazingly good. He could almost feel his brain cells soaking it up and going back to work. Now he could think of what to do. Now he would get back to his own script for this miserable outing and come out as he always did, clean, pressed, and in control. It was not so bad being locked in a bathroom. Basic bodily functions accounted for. He stopped halfway to the fixture he had planned to use and realized another problem. How was he supposed to open his trousers with his hands tied behind him? It wouldn't do any good to yank on the waistband from behind, not with these. They were designed to withstand incredible force. He would think about it later. It was not that big a problem. Yet. On the other hand, he would make do with that one half glass of water and not waste energy trying to get another.
You really should consider the legal aspect.
George's stomach growled. The food the two men were stuffing into their mouths with such indecent haste smelled delicious. He had been given no food, though it was promised for just before you go swimming. He had instead been given the novel experience of cleaning all the plumbing fixtures in the building with a toothbrush held in his teeth. He had not been willing, but the two men had not offered him any alternatives. His bruises throbbed, and his shoulders ached abominably from the strain of his bound arms.
Like what? You think this will come up in a court or something?
The slender one was the bully, George had discovered, when, after some hours of jeering and shoving, they had finally helped him lower his trousers to use the toilet. The stocky one, who looked meaner with that scar across his chin, was only rough, not cruel. In the hours since, the slender man had taken every opportunity to cause pain in ways that would not show on an autopsy.
Probably. My father gets most things to court, and he will certainly sue someone when I'm dead.
It was most inconvenient having one's hands tied. George had not realized how dependent he was on gesture, a habit learned from his father. The men looked at each other.
Poor Lord Thornbuckle. I'm sure he'll be worried.
George stared into space above them, the closest he could come to the pose he usually achieved at these moments.
Oh, I expect my father will represent him, too. A class action suit, I imagine. Damages, negligence.
Nonsense. You don't think you can scare us with your father? I've known better lawyers than your father in my life.
I doubt that. You don't even know who my father is.
He's not in the same class with, Kevil Starbridge Mahoney. Now is he?
My dear lads, he is Kevil Starbridge Mahoney. And if you know him, you know how surely he will pursue anyone who harms his family. I'm George Starbridge Mahoney.
A pause, during which the slender man chewed steadily and the stocky one cast nervous glances from George to his companion. Finally, the slender man swallowed and pushed himself away from the table. George felt his heart begin to pound.
I don't believe you, and I don't like liars.
George hoped his face didn't show how frightened he was, a sudden burst of fear that made him glad he was in the chair and not trying to stand up.
Now wait. We aren't supposed to mark him up, remember?
I won't. Now, what did you say your name was?
George Starbridge Mahoney.
George was going to be hurt anyway, just as the bully at school had twisted ears or arms, no matter what you said. But one might as well tell the truth. And if they concentrated on asking him about himself and his past, perhaps they wouldn't ask where the others might be hiding on the island. He braced himself for whatever the slender man might do, but he did nothing. Then he slipped a hand into a pocket and came out with a glove. The man put the glove on and tapped its fingers on George's head, just hard enough to sting and demonstrate that the fingers were tipped with something hard.
You're sure of that? Then I suppose you know all about Vilgus versus Robertson Colony.
It's against ethics to talk about cases outside professional venues.
A gloved finger probed behind his ear, and George squirmed away.
But sometimes, at home, of course, it did happen.
The whole case was over, appeals and all, long ago. What harm could it do to admit that? And now that he thought about it, there had been a threat against the family. His father had insisted that none of them go out without an escort.
I remember the threat, but I was only 8.
Ah, which would make you now...
23.
Had it really been 15 years? He would never forget the bomb in the vegetable shipment that had destroyed the old kitchen and scared the cook so that she went into early retirement. Of course, she hadn't been in danger. None of the servants were even in the house for the duration of the threat. His father had insisted on that. The finger prodded beneath his chin, only slightly painful so far.
And was the threat ever carried out?
A bomb in the vegetables. It blew all the tiles off the wall.
It occurred to George that this man might have been involved, for all that he didn't look old enough. How old did you have to be to send bombs through the food system? Perhaps he'd started young. Perhaps he wanted revenge.
And what was the outcome? The real outcome?
That, too, he would not forget, because he had been just old enough to recognize the discrepancy between the public news and what his father said to a colleague in the study.
How did you know about the real outcome?
Answer the question!
The Robertson colony paid an indemnity, enough to keep them working hard for the next 50 years, my father said, with no off-planet travel until it was paid. Slocum and DeVries got mind-wiped. Vilgas died, but they hushed it up so his heirs could get the profits.
You do know more about it than the average young sprout. Tell me this, then. When your father, assuming he is your father, approaches the bench, what does he do with his hands?
George's arms strained, trying to reproduce the familiar gesture. He could not say it without doing it.
His left hand's in his vest pocket, as if he felt a pain, and his right hand is holding down the tail of the frill.
The slender man turned away a moment to look at his companion, then turned back to George.
So, if you're Mahoney's son, why should we care?
You said already. You know what he's like. He'll see money somewhere and go after it.
I'm not rich. Why should I worry? He'll go after the deep pockets.
He'll go after anyone involved. Deep pockets hire their own lawyers. Will they hire one for you?
Don't try to scare me. It won't work.
But he glanced at his stocky partner a moment too long. George knew what his father must feel in the courtroom when some change in his opponent's body or face let him know he had scored. He had always assumed law was dull, all those racks of data cubes, all those hours under the helmet. But he had never felt anything like the rush of excitement that now roared through him. Then the slender man's eyes came back to his face, and the triumph chilled. This man enjoyed pain too much to give it up, even for safety.
If I escaped, I could call Lord Thornbuckle. You'd have time to get away if you wanted, although I would testify that you helped me. The people who thought this up are the real criminals. My father would be on your side then.
It's a thought. I'd rather have Mahoney on my side than cross-examining me.
The slender man stared at George in a way that made his insides twitch.
If it came to that, if we can't get it out of this one...
I don't know where the others are. You can get me to tell you where I last saw them, but if they were still there, they'd have been captured. And I've been here at least a day.
George was sure it was 2. Why else would they have shoved him back into the closet for a time and kept him below ground level, except for that one foray of bathroom cleaning in the upstairs suites? He tried very hard not to think about the cave Bubbles had mentioned. He didn't know where it was. He was very glad he didn't know where it was, and they might not be in it anyway.
Time's going to run out. Someone will notice that we're gone and start hunting for us. They can get Michaels to say we went to White Wings easily enough, but we aren't at White Wings, and it'll be obvious we weren't. Besides, that flitter beacon still operates. If anyone checks the satellite logs...
He's right. They should have pulled out as soon as the flitter crashed there. Someone was bound to come looking. It's a wonder they haven't before now. There wasn't really a chance of catching the passengers.
A sporting chance. That's what our admiral likes, remember? The more chance, the more challenge. But if we could get out from under while he takes the blame, then that's a chance I like. You do understand that we want to be free and clear.
Of course.
George's father's son could not miss the undertones. But it was a chance. The slender man nodded at the stocky one.
Go check upstairs. We don't want to run into the admiral. though he said he wouldn't be back until it was over, or we got something out of this one.
George had hoped for a glimpse of the outside world on his way to the communications setup, but the comm shack at Bandon Lodge was in the basement. Two long, light gray corridors and a windowed door. He didn't even know if it was day or night outside. The slender man tapped the main board's controls, screens lit.
Satellite bounce to the main house or to the home station?
I'd try for main house. That'd be quickest. There are people who know me.
Here then. You ready?
George had a moment of panic when he couldn't remember the flitter's number, but it came to him. He pressed the button. Harris, in the supply flitter with the medical squad only a few minutes from landing, stared at the speakers as though George was going to manifest himself through his voice.
Our men are hunting them, the condemned criminals and us both. The hunters have poisoned the water. We need assistance. I'm at Bandon Lodge. The flitter crashed on the island north of Bandon.
Harris found she was holding her breath and let it out. How had that young fool of all of them escaped to Bandon?
And please, recognize the assistance of two men formerly in the employ of the hunters. Svagert Iglund and Cursor Dea. Without them, I could not have made this call.
Another Iglund?
Harris could not tell, over the sound of the flitter itself and the stirs of those around her, if the comm stayed live or dropped the signal. She closed her eyes. She wondered what the militia captain, Sigynd, would do. She knew what she would think of so convenient a signal. Which, of course, Lupescu and his cronies would have heard if they hadn't arranged it. What had George meant by hunters, by condemned criminals? Hunters. She had expected to find Lupescu hunting some rare animal illegally with a band of cronies. She had expected him to be dangerous to innocent youngsters out for a spree. But criminals? People? She shivered suddenly, and Cecilia laid a hand on her arm.
Harris, what is it?
Harris could not see her own face, but Cecilia's reaction told her what she must look like. The older woman drew back as if frightened. Harris saw others glance at her. One stared.
Oh my God. That...
Words literally failed her. The worst words she knew were not bad enough. She fought to breathe past the knot in her throat.
He's hunting people. It's a manhunt. He's not hunting animals at all.
Who?
Lupescu. He's gotten convicts from somewhere.
Her mind raced, fitting it all together. Could they be RSS convicts? She shivered again at the thought of shipmates. Not her crew, of course, but someone's shipmates. Being hunted by Lupescu as if they were only wild beasts. Though it was no better if he had raided other prisons. At least military prisoners would know how to defend themselves, might have a chance. She heard others muttering, the same tones of shock and outrage that she heard in her own voice.
It can't be. It must be crazy. Lord Thornbuckle will tag his hide up in the kennels.
Harris would have said more, but the flitter swerved and she lurched against Cecilia's arm. She turned to peer out the forward canopy. Ahead, the first attacking ships had dropped to their final approach.
I can't believe it. Hunting people, he wouldn't do that. I know you hate what he did to you, what he tried to do to your crew in battle, but he couldn't be crazy enough to think he'd get away with this. Not right under Bunny's nose.
Staring ahead, trying to see what she knew she could not see, how the assault was going, Harris did her best to answer.
He would think that made it better, more sporting. A risk for him other than the risk from the people he hunted. I told you, he once commented that he considered most hunting demeaning because it wasn't dangerous enough. That the proper game for a real man was man.
Cecilia considered this silently as their flitter dropped steadily toward the Bandon field, now occupied by the two militia flitters. Harris appreciated the silence, but knew it wouldn't last. She knew her employer too well.
I don't think that I want to know this person. A disgrace to his uniform.
Yes.
Harris braced herself for landing. The militia squads already down had vanished except for a single soul waving them in. Then they were down safely, onto a quiet field with no sign of conflict. Harris did not need the squad leader's warning. She knew that silence was deceptive. The medical squad went through a routine of some sort. She supposed they were double-checking what equipment was in whose pack or something. The air smelled fresh and wet, heavy with fragrances completely different from the woods and fields near the main house. Harris jumped. She didn't understand. She hated not knowing the local codes, not knowing anything, not having a place in this.
They found the kid. He's hurt.
Harris grabbed Cecilia's hand and squeezed until the older woman's color returned.
George. It has to be George they need. He's the one on this island.
At the lodge proper, the supply flitter crowded the parking area. The medics poured out, and Harris and Cecilia followed. No one stopped them. Harris saw no sign of trouble until they came to the room where George lay with a medic already working on him. One dead body sprawled across the control board of the communications shack. Another clump of medics worked on a third man. Cecilia leaned against the wall but pushed Harris forward.
Find out. For his father.
Harris had no interest in George's father. She picked her way across the floor, blood spattered and already littered with the detritus of emergency medical care, to a point where she could see George without interfering. He was alive, breathing on his own, with one IV line in. He looked dirty and pale, and both older and younger than she remembered him. She knew that look from the youngsters she'd seen in her own ship's sickbay. Being flat on their backs in clean pajamas made them look like children, but what they had been through aged them.
What happened to him?
Caught in the crossfire. Small caliber in the abdomen. Missed the big stuff.
Which didn't mean it felt good, or even that he would recover. Just that he was likely to make it back to a hospital without dying on the way.
Caught in crossfire. Maybe and maybe not. Perhaps someone wanted to get rid of witnesses. There must be more than one traitor in Bunny's pay.
Harris watched the medics, who seemed to go about their business as quickly and competently as any she'd seen, and then met George's gaze.
Captain, where's Ronnie?
On the other island, I presume. Militia went there. He'll be fine.
He might not be, but George needed to hear the best chance, not the worst. A medic put a warning hand on George's shoulder.
Don't talk. You need to lie still.
George's eyes locked on Harris's.
Cave. Might be in the cave. Bubbles said... Oh.
I understand. Bubbles knew about a cave and they might be in it. All of them?
No. Ronnie. Hurt.
He shouldn't talk. Don't bother him. He's got other injuries, too.
Harris glanced down and saw that they'd cut George's shirt away now, revealing the deep bruises along his side. Broken ribs, maybe.
He shot me. He...
It's all right, George.
Time enough later to find out which he George meant. From the glazed look in his eyes, they had given him some drug, and he wouldn't be thinking clearly now. She hoped he had been right about the cave.
Everything will be fine.
The medics lifted George onto a stretcher and rolled him away. He lay quiet, eyes already closed. Her mind raced. A cave... A cave Bubbles knew about. Did Lupescu? Ronnie hurt, and not in the cave. What kind of hurt? If Ronnie was hurt, why hadn't he been captured? And again, did Lupescu know about the cave? Did the others being hunted? Did the militia captain know about that cave? And if so... She went back to Cecilia, who looked less pale than when she'd come in.
George has a gunshot wound. He should survive, assuming Bunny's got a good trauma center in his hospital.
Very good. Riding horses at speed is hardly a safe hobby.
He hasn't lost anything vital yet. Could you hear what he said?
No, not really.
There's a cave on the island where the others are. Bubbles knew about it, and George thinks the others might be hiding in it. Would the militia captain know about it? Did you ever hear of it?
A cave? No, I didn't. I don't know if anyone else would, besides the children who camped there. A big cave.
George didn't know, I suspect. But the militia captain needs to. If there's a cave, anyone might be in it. The youngsters, or the hunters, or whoever they're hunting.
Harris looked around. Someone had dragged the corpse away, and the other wounded man, whoever he was, and one medic was stuffing medical trash in a sack.
We can't just comm call the militia commander. Lupescu would overhear it. If that's where the youngsters are hiding...
Cecilia pushed away from the wall. We'll go tell him.
Yes, but...
Harris stifled her doubts. They'd been told to stay here, safely out of trouble, and she'd agreed to that. She looked around for the person in charge. The person in charge, busily arranging transport to a hospital for George and the other wounded man, was in no mood to listen. Harris had no idea what the insignia on his collar meant, but he was acting like a harried sergeant.
The captain said you were to stay here, and here you'll stay. You don't even know where this cave is, or if the kids are in it, or if anyone else knows about it.
That's why...
The captain's got good maps of the island. If there's a cave worth worrying about, he'll know. He's got a bloody mess over there. Just because you used to be a spaceship commander doesn't give you the right to throw your weight around here. Captain Siggins said to keep you safe here, and that's exactly what I'll do. Now, if you'll get out of my way so I can do my job...
Excuse me.
No use arguing with this sort. She had seen them before. The problem now was working around him. And that was most easily done out of his sight.